This is Dr. Anthony J. Tomasino and is teaching on the Ten Commandments. This is session number one, the Ten Commandments and the Law.
Hi, I'm Tony Tomasino, the author of a book on the Ten Commandments that came out a number of years ago, entitled Written Upon the Heart, the Ten Commandments for Today's Christian. That book actually started out as a series of sermons, and then from a series of sermons, it went to a series of Sunday school classes, and then from a series of Sunday school classes, it went to a series of lectures that I presented to different clergy groups and so on. And from there, I thought, well, I might as well gather all my notes together and put them into some form that other people can appreciate as well. So what I'm doing at this point is reflecting on, well, 30 years of thinking since I first wrote that book, as well as some of the major points that that I brought up in that treatment of the Ten Commandments so long ago. Very practical. I believe the Ten Commandments are very practical. I believe that the Ten Commandments need to be understood in the context in which they were given, as well as in our context. We might talk about the merging of the horizons of the ancient Near Eastern world and our current society, which is why these are Ten Commandments for today's Christian. You know, sounds kind of mod, I guess, or something, but even so, I think it is an appropriate title in its way, because we face different questions today. We face different challenges than maybe they did 50 years ago or 500 years ago, and certainly different challenges than they did 3,000 years ago. So the Ten Commandments still give us guidance for how to live if we understand them, if we appreciate them, if we apply them in our new and our own lives and situations. So we're going to be looking at the Ten Commandments as they relate and as they as part of, or even we could say the foundation of, the biblical law code, the laws that were laid down in the books of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, etc. So, first place to begin with this treatment, this topic, would be just understanding what we mean here by law and how the Ten Commandments fit into that whole law tradition. Now, think, first of all, let me give kind of a little more of a current, I guess, context for Ten Commandments. Now, the Ten Commandments in church tradition, also known as a Decalogue, and I'll use that word from time to time, they are regarded as one of the three foundational documents of Christian faith. And the three foundational documents of the Christian faith, according to church tradition, are the Ten Commandments, which provide an ethical foundation, the Lord's Prayer, which provides a spiritual foundation, and the Apostles' Creed, which provides the theological foundation of the Christian faith. Oftentimes, when I start at a new church, what I do is I present all three of these in a series of sermons, starting with the Ten Commandments and then moving on. Usually during Lent, I do the Lord's Prayer, and then in the summer, I do the Apostles' Creed. And so we cover the entire foundation of the Christian faith, and therefore every church that I have ever served has had a total full basis of all the necessary knowledge of being Christians. Don't I wish? But anyway, but this is a good place to start. Sometimes we hear the Ten Commandments called a basic law code. The basic law code of ancient Israel. Back when I wrote this book, there was a lot of debate about whether or not the Ten Commandments could be hanging in courtrooms and whether or not we should be putting them in every school and all this kind of thing. And oftentimes it was argued that the Ten Commandments are truly the basis of any just society. Well, I don't agree with that personally, because I think that the Ten Commandments are made for a specific society, a society that worships the Lord, the God of Israel, not for any society. And our society, whether or not we worship the Lord is a debatable question these days, I guess. The Ten Commandments have been sometimes presented as sort of like the panacea. You know, why do we have school shootings? Well, if we had the Ten Commandments up in all of our classrooms, we wouldn't have school shootings going on like this kind of thing. I'm not so convinced about that either. The Ten Commandments aren't magic, but they are wise. And that's what I hope to be able to bring out in this study, in this treatment of the Ten Commandments, is the wisdom and the knowledge which are embedded in these commandments. Interesting thing about the Ten Commandments is that even back when there was this big fight over whether or not the Ten Commandments could be put in classrooms and in courtrooms and so on, there was a survey taken, and I believe it was by Christianity Today. I might be mistaken on that. But they asked people to name the Ten Commandments. Christians, to name the Ten Commandments. How many commandments do you think the average Christian could name? Most of them got four. Four out of the Ten Commandments right. If they were asked to put them in order, almost everybody failed. So even though people seem to think that these are so very, very important, so very vital to the understanding of a just society, most people are woefully uninformed about what they actually say. So let us try to get this fleshed out a little bit over the next several lectures here. The first place to begin is with the whole concept of law, because we've talked about the fact that the Ten Commandments are the foundation of the law code of ancient Israel. And this is a significant kind of thing. We think about law, and I remember reading a number of years ago in a book about law in the Old Testament, and it started off with a poem that basically argued that we don't really know what law is. That defining law is very hard, and I guess you might say it's like pornography. You know, it's one of those things that you know it when you see it. I don't think it's quite that bad, really. According to the Cambridge Dictionary, law is a rule usually made by a government that is used to order the way in which a society behaves. That seems pretty straightforward, pretty simple. We have rules, we have governments enforcing the rules, and we have regulations of behaviors. Now, on the other hand, a lot of people stop with simply rules. You know, the law is the rules. And it doesn't matter if you're talking about civil society or if you're talking about a game. You still got the laws that you have to obey and the things that you have to do. So most of us are familiar with the concept of law, and we think of the law in very, I would say, kind of absolute terms. You know, speed limit's 55, that is the law. If you go 56 miles per hour, you're breaking the law. If the law says, you know, if you loiter in a street corner, you can be fined $50. Yeah, so that is the rule. That is the regulation, and that can be enforced if somebody chooses to do so. And so there is that sense among many people that the law is absolute in that way. And many Christians take that same idea and put it back on the biblical laws. And I'm going to argue that the biblical laws are a little bit more flexible than that, and for reasons that we'll see in a minute. But in the ancient Near East, law was a little bit different from the way that we tend to think about law in our day and in our society. There has been a lot of study on where law came from. And we know that there were many different ancient societies, that even before there was writing, there were laws. The people in these different societies and these different groups, they had to have laws, regulations, in order to prevent people from killing each other, to prevent them from stealing from each other, to give them a sense of what each person's role in the society was. So oral law codes have existed from probably as soon as people started getting together and forming groups and trying to create things of some that we might call society. Law codes. Now, the law codes were imposed by various kinds of lords to establish their authority over local powers. And we see this happening as soon as we get kingdoms growing up, as soon as we get empires growing up, that the rulers of some of these city-states, and Mesopotamia in particular, they began to try to impose their rule over those of these different tribal groups that existed under their realms. So you have this shift, you might say, from the, that you have this tribe that has their rules regarding how you deal with, say, adultery. You have this tribe that has a different set of rules. Well, then you have a king who conquers all these various groups, and he says, okay, now I'm going to show you, you're going to do it my way. And he was not necessarily abrogating or trying to negate what was being done by these previous groups, but rather what the king in this time point is trying to do is simply assert his own authority to show that they are answering now to a higher authority. So you've got these suzerains establishing these powers, and when we look at ancient Near Eastern texts, written documents that we have from ancient Mesopotamia in particular, some of the most ancient texts that have ever been discovered were law codes. And many people are familiar with the laws of Hammurabi by this point, 1750 BC. But Hammurabi is actually fairly late in the scene. The earliest extant law code that we have comes from a fellow by the name of Ur-Nammu, who was in ancient Sumer, who probably about 2500 BC maybe, and these laws were remarkably similar to some of the laws that we see in later law codes. A lot of overlap. And so we've got a lot of these law collections, very ancient texts that show how these kings were imposing their authority over the various peoples under their realms. So this is something that has been a bit of a debate, and I've had to had some arguments with some folks about this, but good folks, you know. But the question about where the laws come from, and I've had friends say, well, the Bible laws are different because the biblical laws come from God, where the laws of the ancient Near Eastern peoples came from the kings, and the kings claimed to present these laws. The kings claimed to present the laws, but they claimed they got the laws from the gods, okay? This was the source of their authority. And we see this, for instance, in the law code of Hammurabi. We see this depiction of him standing, receiving a tablet of laws from the god Shamash, Shamash being the god of justice in ancient Babylon. The laws were a stipulation, a covenant stipulation in a sense. So you've got this king, he has conquered these various peoples, and now he's saying, you people need to agree to these new regulations. There's a new sheriff in town. You're going to answer to me. And there's a covenant relationship between the king and his people. So the people are, in a sense, taking upon themselves the rights, whatever they might be, of being part of, say, Hammurabi's empire. But at the same time, they're taking upon themselves the responsibilities of obeying Hammurabi's laws. But interesting thing here, and this goes through the entire ancient Near Eastern law tradition. Yeah? Law exists in covenant relationship. The king has a covenant relationship with these peoples, which gives him the right to impose upon them the laws. And the same thing, of course, we see in the Assyrians, the same thing in the Hittites. Everybody agreed that it is the king's rule and the fact that he has done things for the people that gives him the right to impose upon them these covenant obligations, which take the form of laws. Now, in the ancient Near East, there are two major kind of forms in which the law is expressed. And these were first identified by a fellow by the name of Albrecht Alt. He came up with these words. I think that everybody's known for a long time that the forms of the law varied. But Albrecht Alt coined these terms apodictic and casuistic to describe two types of laws. Okay? Apodictic comes from words that basically means by the word, by the dictate sort of thing. Okay, so by pronouncement, thou shalt not. That's an apodictic law. Okay? The vast majority of the laws that we find in ancient Near Eastern law codes are what we call casuistic laws. And that is the case law. If a man has an ox that he knew would gore people, and the man has done nothing to pen up his ox, then, and that ox kills somebody, then that man shall be put to death. Okay? That kind of thing. If this happens, then you do this. That's what we call a casuistic law. And that is far and away the vast majority of the laws that we find in the ancient Near East. This is a copy of Hammurabi's stele. His law code is all inscribed along here. These were probably set up all around the borders of his kingdom. But here we see the god Shamash. You know he's a god because he's got these horns on his head. This was the way that the Mesopotamians would depict their gods, as they always had horns of some sort. So he's got this whole set of horns up here on top of his head. And he's kind of big, looks like a guy, you know. And he is handing the laws to King Hammurabi. So Hammurabi is claiming here in very graphic terms that the god Shamash, the god of justice, is the source of law. And these laws are very typically casuistic rather than apodictic. And here we can see, for instance, this is from Hammurabi's law. If anyone bring an accusation against a man, and the accused go to the river and leap into the river, and if he sink to the river, his accuser shall take possession of his house. Yeah. So, but if the river prove that the accused is not guilty and he escape unhurt, then he who had brought the accusation shall be put to death, while he had leaped into the river shall take possession of the house that belonged to his accusers. Sometimes this reminds people of the witch trials where, you know, if you throw a witch in the river, if she's really a witch, she'll float because she's made of wood, you know. And if she sinks, then you put her to death because, if she sinks, then that means she was innocent. Right. So, you know, darned if you do and darned if you don't kind of thing. But that's not really what's quite going on here, because you take the accused, he jumps in the river. If he swims, good, that means he's innocent. But if the river pull him down and drown him, that means he was guilty. So that's the idea here. Fascinating thing about Hammurabi's code, and we found this to be the case in many of the ancient law codes, is as we've deciphered more and more texts, one of the things that has come around is we have lots of records from court proceedings. So we can see, in many cases, what decisions the judges rendered when these different cases came before them. And remarkably enough, Hammurabi's code wasn't enforced. Even though they had this wonderful, well-designed law code, which people even to this day say study as and say, you know, this is remarkable stuff here, The judges didn't use Hammurabi's code when they went to decide their cases. I say, you know, mostly symbolic, maybe we could say. Hammurabi's suggestions, you know, maybe. But the remarkable thing, of course, is that and now the basic principles clearly are understood, you know. It was in the penalties that we find that there was a great deal of variation. And so everybody agreed, you know, if a man committed adultery, that was wrong. Man, wife should be put, and the adulterer and adulteress should be put to death, kind of thing. But there was a whole lot of leeway built into that system. And we find this particularly, it's interesting when you get to the Middle Assyrian law codes, because they are very, very explicit about this. They say, if a man is committing adultery with a married woman, and he has seduced her and committed adultery with her, they shall both be put to death. But if the husband is inclined to let his wife live, then let her live. And in that case, the man won't be killed either. If the man is inclined to cut his wife's nose off, which is one of the ways they dealt with adultery, then they would cut the man's nose off, too. Yeah? The Assyrians were real big into cutting body parts off for some reason. Kind of creepy. But anyway. But point being here, that these laws were more like guidelines, not in the way we typically think of laws today. You know, so it's sort of like we've got a 55-mile-per-hour speed limit, okay? And you go 56 miles per hour, you can get a $100 fine. And maybe it's gone up since then. That's what they did to me when I was in Chicago. Anyway, you got a 55-mile-per-hour speed limit. You know, it's sort of up to the cop's discretion, right? Whether or not they're going to actually give you a ticket for going 56 miles an hour. Now, they could technically give you a ticket for going 56 miles an hour. Technically, they could charge you $100. But most of them are going to give you some leeway and going to think, well, you know, everybody else is going 56. Why should I pick on you, kind of thing? Yeah. There was a certain amount of what we might call grace or lenience or simple discretion built into these law codes. Now, how does this compare to the law of the Israelites, the law that we find in the Hebrew Bible? And again, one of the things that people get so hung up on is, oh, the Old Testament laws are so harsh. Oh, these people, they were killing everybody for everything, right? Well, let's think about that. Yep. Going back here. First of all, let's talk a little bit about what we mean by law, Torah. Usually gets translated law, but really the word Torah means teaching or instruction. And we find this, for instance, in the book of Proverbs. This is the word that is used in the book of Proverbs for teaching. It does not have the same connotation of a rule. It can, but it doesn't necessarily have that connotation. It's more, in a sense, it kind of arises more out of the wisdom tradition. Teaching or instruction. So, the word first appears in the book of Genesis 26. Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws. So that's the first place that this word appears. Now, question, did Abraham have the laws of Moses? No, of course not. He lived at least 500 years before Moses. He does not have the laws of Moses. So what laws are we talking about here? We're talking about God's general instructions to Abraham. You know, like laws about, you know, not marrying your sister. Oh, wait a minute. What we find is that Abraham was acting in good faith with the instructions given to him by God. And that's really what's meant here. That is what this word is intending in that passage. Okay? We use, of course, the word Torah as a technical word for the first five books of the Old Testament. It's typically called Torah. And not only do it apply to the legal materials, again, a teaching of parents, that's in the book of Proverbs, prophetic instruction is also called Torah. Okay? So it's a much broader term than we usually think of when we think of law. And I would say a much broader concept as well, as we'll see later as we go along here. Few other words that are also used in this context. The word hukah means a statute. And a statute is a little bit different. It seems to come from a word that means to engrave. And in this case, it's all talking about an immutable principle. Okay? And you can think about it in like terms of it is an immutable principle that people do not commit adultery. But there is wisdom involved in how one deals with a case of someone committing adultery. And there was a great deal of variation that was permitted. The immutable principle is clear. The law, the Torah, regarding that immutable principle, a little more fuzzy. So, yet another word here, mitzvot, that's the commands that he commanded, comes from the word tzavah, which simply means to command. And mitzvot, this is kind of an interesting word because in Judaism, and to this very day, it has a sense of more like good deeds rather than commands. So, if somebody gives money to the poor, that's a mitzvah. A good deed. Yeah. So mitzvot is an interesting one because in the Bible, in the Hebrew Bible, very clearly it has this sense of an uttered commandment, and yet it has taken on this more broad sense of just general good works. It can also, by the way, mean commandments. It does mean that as well in Judaism. So in the New Testament, we have this Greek word nomos. Which is the same word that's used by the ancient Greeks regarding their laws. You know, it's a word that we get things like astronomy, you know, the law of the stars and things of this sort. It can have either the sense of a tradition or a law. So that, and that's, again, a little bit different from what we usually think about it, because when we think about the laws of the stars, we're thinking about physics, and we're thinking about things that are sort of set in stone, more than set in stone. They're set in the very ether and the Big Bang and all that kind of stuff, you know, and they're immutable and eternal, and that's why the world is always going to be working the way it is, because of the laws of physics or the laws of astronomy or the laws of the various kinds of principles of science. But it also has a sense of tradition and those things which are normally done. So let's talk about the origins and the developments of the Israelite law a little bit here. You know, we talked about how in the ancient Near East that there were these different groups that were brought together under a king, like Ur-Nammu or Hammurabi, and as they assembled these different peoples, then these different peoples had their own existing laws, but now they were having a new code imposed upon them by their sovereign, with whom they are entering into a covenant relationship. How is this analogous to what we see in Israel? I would argue it's very analogous to what we see in Israel. So we have the different tribes of Israel, you know, 12 tribes of Israel. There are lots of questions about how formally they were related to one another and all these kinds of issues that arise. You know, critical scholars believe that the tribes of Israel were originally completely separate groups and didn't have any kind of actual genetic relationship to each other. Yeah, I don't think that most of us would hold that, you know. But the point is that you did have these different tribes that were, in some sense, had a very strong identity with their tribes more so than they had with the nation as a whole, really. And each of these tribes would have had their own regulations, their own rules. What does it mean to be a member of, say, the tribe of Benjamin? What does it mean to be a member of the tribe of Judah? Well, they had their rules. They had their regulations that would regulate their own society. So it wasn't like the people of Judah before the coming of Moses had no sense of law. And clearly they would have had laws. They would have had ideas and procedures for how they would deal with lawbreakers and so on. All that existed before the time of Moses. And then we have Moses come along, and he receives all these laws from God on Mount Sinai. God is, in a sense, exerting his authority over those tribal regulations of those people that already had. Now, no doubt, the people of Judah had ways of dealing with murderers. No doubt, the people of the tribe of Levi had their ways of dealing with adulterers. God is saying, you are entering into covenant relationship with me. This is the way I want it done. Amen. Now, did God give everything to Moses on Mount Sinai? Well, the interesting thing, because according to Jewish tradition, God gave literally everything to Moses on Mount Sinai, including not only the laws of that we find in the Torah, but also all the prophets and all the writings and all the rabbinic teachings as well. And God just told Moses, now keep all this stuff quiet here, because if the Gentiles get a hold of this stuff, they'll ruin it. But yeah, that's rabbinic teachings that aren't necessarily something that we're going to put a whole lot of historical stock in. It has its purposes, but not history, I don't think. What we can say is that God gave laws to Moses on Sinai, but we can also say that there was a growth of these legal traditions in the courts. And we see this already in the books of the Torah, we have something happen where we have immediately after giving of the laws, we have this Egyptian guy who curses the name of God and in the camp of the Israelites. And so the people go before God and they say, well, what should we do about this? And God says, take him out and stone him to death. And so they write it into the law. If anybody, you know, blasphemes the name of God, we stone him to death. So we can see that already in the Torah, there is this provision for the extension, for the building, for the expansion of the law beyond just what is written or what was given to Moses on the mountainside. Now, the Bible presents it all as being coming in the laws of Moses, in the time of Moses. I think that's more a matter of historiography than history, the way that they wrote history in those days. But at any rate, it's clear that many of the laws that we find in the Torah, I can't say it's clear, but it seems apparent that many of the laws that we find in the Torah actually come from later periods and have been brought together in the Torah because they represent the same kind of tradition. Big question about when the Pentateuch, the five books of Moses, came together in the form we have them. Theory that has been around for a long time is that the laws were really codified under Ezra. And I think there's a lot of good reason. There's a reason why this theory has stuck around a long time. And according to the book of Ezra, Ezra gathered the various law codes and he came down to Jerusalem, and he stood before the people and he read the laws. And as he read the laws to the people were weeping and they're ripping their garments and everything because they hadn't been doing this stuff, including things like, for instance, the Feast of Tabernacles. It said they hadn't celebrated the Feast of Tabernacles since the days of Joshua. So, why were they not doing it? Was it because, did they actually even know they were supposed to do it? Well, according to Ezra, it doesn't seem like they knew they were supposed to be doing it. So, the question is, the rabbinic tradition says that if Moses hadn't written the law, Ezra would have. And there's a sense that maybe Ezra was perhaps the ghostwriter here or something, but Ezra clearly brought together many of these traditions that had been associated with Moses, with the legal traditions of Israel, and he promulgated them. He had the authority of the Persian Empire behind him to enforce these codes and to make them really the law of the land. It's not to say that the laws didn't exist or that the traditions didn't exist before the time of Ezra, because we know they did. It's just that they ignored them most of the time. This is Jeremiah's big complaint against the people of Israel. In one of his chapters of Jeremiah, we'll get to this later, he says, you know, your people, you're ignoring the Sabbath day. You're doing all this trade in the Sabbath day. They had this understanding that they shouldn't be doing it, but they're doing it anyway. Ezra apparently had the ability to not only bring these things together, you know, he's called a scribe, you know, legal scholar who could bring these traditions into this kind of written form that was compact and pocket size, whatever. Scroll size, about this big, maybe. But he could bring these things, together, and he could impose them upon the people and make them essentially the law of the land. And that seems to be something new. Okay. Now, a little bit further, Old Testament law here. Typically, the form of the Old Testament laws is casuistic, just like the forms in Hammurabi's code, just like the forms in the code of Ur-Nammu, just like the forms in the Middle Assyrian laws. So you have things like this, you know, if you buy a Hebrew servant, he's to serve you for 6 years, but in the seventh year, he shall go free without paying anything. So if you buy, then, you know, in the seventh year, he goes free. If he comes alone, he goes free alone. But if he's acquired a wife, then she goes with him. That's casuistic law. Sometimes we have apodictic laws in the Torah. And here we see something like, for instance, in Leviticus 18:21, do not cause any of your children to pass over to Molech, whatever that means. There's been a lot of debate about that. It sounds like they're talking about child sacrifice. I think they're talking about child sacrifice, but some people have thought maybe it's just a dedication rite. I don't know. I think they're talking about child sacrifice. You must not profane the name of the Lord your God. I am Yahweh. Leviticus 18:21. That is apodictic. So, where do the Ten Commandments fit in this? Well, obviously the Ten Commandments are apodictic. Thou shalt not kill. Thou shalt not commit adultery. That's as apodictic as you can get. But another interesting thing about the Ten Commandments, and something that sort of sets it apart from, say, the laws of Hammurabi, or even, say, some of the laws in Leviticus and Numbers and so on, is that none of them include any penalties. There we go. So we have something like, you shall not kill. Okay, well, what do you do to somebody who kills? Doesn't say in the Ten Commandments. You shall not commit adultery. Doesn't say. What do you do to the lawbreakers? How do you treat them? It doesn't say in the Ten Commandments. And then there's also the problem that the Ten Commandments tend to be rather ambiguous when you think about it. And this is where we get into all kinds of various interpretations and so on. You know, one of the things you'll always hear from people who don't know the Bible very well is they'll say something like, well, you can't have war because the Bible says you shall not kill. There is some ambiguity in that English translation, but that's not really what I'm talking about here. There is no ambiguity in the Hebrew in that one. But there are commandments that seem to be rather ambiguous. Like, for instance, honor your father and mother. What does that mean? How do you honor your father and mother? They probably had some ideas what that involved in ancient Near Eastern times, and we'll talk about that when we get to that one. But there is certainly some ambiguity built into that, you know? Take something like, remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. You know, 6 days, do all your work. Now, this one expands a little bit, but not to some extent that we can identify what work is. And this, of course, is something that the Pharisees absolutely obsessed about how do you define work? Yeah, and so that's how you end up with the regulations saying things like, if somebody breaks their law on the Sabbath day, you were allowed to soak it, but you weren't allowed to rub it. Or if somebody's pillow is lumpy, you were allowed to fluff it with your head on the Sabbath day, but you weren't allowed to fluff it with your hands on the Sabbath day, because that would constitute work. Okay? There is some ambiguity. How do you define work, right? And the rabbis tried to take all that ambiguity away. Weren't necessarily very successful. But another thing to think about here with the Ten Commandments is, really, they're kind of unenforceable. And here I'm thinking primarily about that last commandment, which is totally unique in the ancient world. We're going to talk about that, of course, in our last lecture. But who would ever pass a law like, you shall not want what somebody else has got? How do you enforce it? Do you have the thought police going about trying to read people's minds? Or do you have to keep an eye on people to see if they're looking lustfully at somebody else's wife or something, There really was no way you could enforce that law if you're viewing it as a rule. And there lies the big point. Is it indeed a rule in the way we usually think about a rule? No, it is not. It is a covenant stipulation. Israel is entering into a covenant relationship with their God. Okay? And the Ten Commandments are the obligations that the people of Israel have been called to accept as being part of that covenant relationship with their God. Just like the various groups under King Hammurabi had to accept Hammurabi's rules, Hammurabi's laws, and because of this of the benefits and the that they were receiving from being part of Hammurabi's kingdom, so too the people of Israel are entering into a covenant relationship with their God, and they have to accept the responsibilities of that covenant. And I do believe that the Ten Commandments are the foundation of that law code. They are not the laws per se. They are the obligations, the stipulations that they are bringing upon themselves. I like to think of the Ten Commandments more as vows than as rules. Okay? And here I do think that, you have the right to remain silent. Anything you say may be used against you. Yeah. The marriage metaphor is a common biblical symbol for the relationship between Israel and his people. And this is brought out particularly in the prophets, in the prophet Hosea, of course. We have one of the most beautiful and pathetic explorations of that theme in Ezekiel, just, heartrending. This idea that God and his people are in a wedded relationship, and God loves his people and he's committed to them, and they keep turning their backs on him and they keep committing adultery and doing this kind of thing. But, you think about a wedding and a marriage, and one of the main things, of course, we do is the exchange of the vows. I promise that, I will always be kind and patient and gentle with you. I promise I won't cheat. And a lot of other lies like that. I promise not to take the whole bed. Oh, yeah, this kind of good stuff, right? That are the foundation for the relationship. But one of the main things that people vow when they enter into that marriage relationship is that whole thing about forsaking all others, I will be true to you alone. Okay? These kind of vows, by the way, are not something that is necessarily new and modern to us. I mean, they do go back a very ancient, long way. And even back in the times when these laws were given, they had marriage contracts where they would have these kind of regulations that that they would have to undertake. And so this metaphor is very apropos to what's going on with Israel here. And it starts with this whole thing about the exclusivity of the relationship. You're going to marry me. You're not going to have any others. Yeah? And where is that? We see that in the Ten Commandments right at the very beginning. You know, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. You shall have no other gods. And so this is a monogamous relationship we're talking about here. I suppose you could argue that God could have other wives, but I don't think we're going to go there. But anyway, it of course requires a commitment on behalf of the people. Nobody is going to be able to say for sure whether or not someone is coveting. Nobody is going to be able to say for certain that somebody is desiring their neighbor's mule. Yeah? And so, who's going to police that? Yourself. You're going to police it yourself. You're taking the responsibility upon yourself to keep these commandments. That is really what these commandments are about. They're about this relationship between God and his people and the responsibilities that the people are taking upon themselves to do these obligations that are laid out in the Ten Commandments. Now, let me talk a little bit about some of the historical critical issues regarding the Ten Commandments, because these have come up in many different contexts, and there is a lot of discussion about the Ten Commandments even to this day. A lot of scholars just don't know what to make of them, you know, and you'll hear a lot of comments to the effect that the Ten Commandments as we have them in Exodus 20 cannot be the original way they were given or the original form of them, and that they must have been changed a lot through the years and so on and so forth. Why do they have problems with this? Well, you know, first of all, there's a whole question about oftentimes historical criticism just denies the possibility of the miraculous. So the idea of God appearing on a mountaintop and scribbling these things down on tablets of stone, that seems just a little far-fetched to some people, right? So they're going to reject that just because of the fact that that there is this miraculous element. And it's kind of funky when you think about it, but there is a lot of skepticism about even the existence of Moses. And when I was in graduate school in my PhD program at Chicago, I was kind of surprised. I had a friend who was I will come out and say it. He was a Catholic priest. I had studied the Pontifical Institute in Rome.
Yeah.
But he and I were talking one time about Moses, and I don't even remember how we got into the topic, but I mentioned about something said it's pretty clear to me that Moses existed. And he said, seriously? And I said, well, yeah. He says, how could you believe that? He says, he's obviously a made-up character. And he went through and he gave his several reasons why he thought Moses was a made-up character. And I came back with the fact that several of these things that he mentioned, like, for instance, the fact that Moses had an Egyptian name, are actually evidence for Moses' historicity rather than Moses' non-historicity, you know? I really don't think that the Hebrews, if they wanted to make up their biggest hero, would have given him an Egyptian name. And furthermore, they didn't really know what the name meant because, the folk etymology we have in the Bible is that he was drawn from the river, and that comes from the Hebrew word mashak, which means to draw. But we know that the name Moses actually is Egyptian, meaning, you know, born of or something like, or a son of, like in the name Ramesses, begotten of Ra, Thutmosis, begotten of Thut, and so on and so forth. So Moses' name is clearly Egyptian, and I have no problems with the question of his authenticity myself. But if there were no Moses, obviously, then there was no Moses going up on a mountain to get the Ten Commandments. There are other people who do believe in the existence of Moses, but they believe that, and I remember reading this from a fairly well-known Bible scholar who said something to the effect that, he says, yeah, Moses certainly existed. He just looms so large in the historical record that he must have existed. But he said, but on the other hand, Moses had so much to do that it would be hard to imagine that he could have made time to be receiving the laws and getting the law code and getting all that. So really, it was probably the laws all come from later times and were just attributed down to Moses.
Yeah.
How do you prove that? You know, that's just somebody's opinion, right? I think we're on a little more solid ground when we start talking about the question of the original form of the Decalogue. But still, even here, I think we're kind of shaky. The reason why we can talk about some dispute here is because we have a couple of different versions of the Ten Commandments in the Bible and a couple of places where the Ten Commandments are alluded to where there are some questions about wording and order and these kinds of things. Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5. We have some significant differences. I'll point those out in a minute. But the fact that we have some differences between these two seems to imply that maybe between the time of Deuteronomy and the time of Exodus writing and the time of Deuteronomy's writing, or if you want to take it out of the historical context, just say between the tradition of the Deuteronomist and the tradition of the guy who wrote Exodus, you have a development in thinking, or even just two different streams of thought, two different traditions that preserved different, slightly different forms of the Ten Commandments. Okay. And so that raises the question, well, which one was the original, right? Many argue that the commandments were originally shorter, like number 6 through 9, you shall not kill, you shall not commit adultery, etc., etc., and that they were all originally negative. So honor your father and mothers was probably originally, they would say, something like, do not dishonor your father and mother. Instead of remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy, it was originally something like, do not break the Sabbath day or something like that. And then they expanded on it later. It's possible. I don't see it as likely necessarily. I don't see it as necessary personally. Then there is also the question of whether or not there are actually Ten Commandments, because in Exodus 20 it doesn't say Ten Commandments. It just said, you know, these are the commandments. It doesn't actually use the word ten there, and but it does elsewhere in Exodus 34, and it does also in Deuteronomy. It talks about the Ten Commandments. So, another thing that we see often is the idea that all of the Ten Commandments were originally capital offenses. So murder, you know, is a capital offense. Adultery, capital offense. And so there's been this argument that some of these things were added on because, like coveting. Coveting could not be considered a capital offense, but stealing. One of the things that many scholars argue about stealing is it originally referred only to kidnapping. Because kidnapping was a capital offense, stealing, robbing from your neighbor, was not considered a capital offense. Again, I don't think that there's any basis for that argument either. A couple of reasons. First of all, it's not clear that that these things were capital offenses. Adultery, and we're going to talk about this when we get to adultery, but you know, and no point in not repeating myself, I guess. You think about it, how many people in the Old Testament were actually killed for committing adultery? Yep. The answer is zero. You know, nobody in the Old Testament actually died. There are several people committed adultery. In fact, a lot of people committed adultery in the Old Testament. And it's mentioned a number of times. But nobody was ever put to death for committing adultery, even though the law says, you know, stone the adulterers to death. We have the famous story, again, of Hosea and his wife Gomer. What happens? Apparently, Hosea was going to sell his wife into slavery. Well, we know that was a common penalty for adultery in those days. That if you wanted to get rid of your wife, as she had committed adultery, and it was clear that she had done it, she was guilty, you could sell her as a slave. That was one of the ways that it was dealt with. And that apparently was what Hosea chose to do. We've got King David, the most famous adulterer of them all, you know, and even murderer for that matter. And what happens to him? Well, God put away his sin so that David did not die. Of course, he had all kinds of trouble in his household ever after. But then we have in the prophets mentions a number of times of people who have committed adultery. We have references to people being unfaithful to both their spouses and the men complaining about it. But what are they doing? They're not doing anything about it. You know, we don't have, if we've got all this adultery going on, you would think that we'd have lots of people dying in Israel, but apparently not. So this idea that these things were all capital offenses doesn't really hold a lot of water when you look at the way that they were actually enforced. Sabbath breaking, I already talked about the fact that Sabbath breaking occurred quite regularly. Supposedly, I mean, ideally, maybe, apparently, it was a capital offense. But it was not really enforced that way. Yeah. So if we're going to say, well, there's clearly some possible exclusions here or exceptions, then why not an exception for something like stealing? Why not an exception for something like coveting? Yeah. I don't think that this notion, again, is that strong a argument. So how many versions of the Ten Commandments are we talking about here? Well, scholars like to distinguish between Exodus 20, which they call the Ethical Decalogue, which is those commandments that we're all familiar with, and then Exodus 34, 10 through 26, which they call the Ritual Decalogues. Now, I was going to pull out a Bible here. Not a King James Version, though. Here we go, New International Version. And we'll look at Exodus 34. What they do is they attribute these to two different source documents. Typically, they argue that Exodus 34 is a version that comes from maybe the priestly tradition or the Deuteronomic tradition or something of that sort, whereas Exodus 20 comes from the Yahwistic tradition. And so, but they call Exodus 34 another Decalogue, and the reason is because that phrase, the Ten Commandments, is actually used there. However, let's read this passage and see what it's really saying here. The Lord said to Moses, chisel out two stone tablets like the first ones, and I will write on them the words that you were to write in the first tablets which you broke. Yeah, thanks, God. I really needed that reminder. Be ready in the morning. Then come up on Mount Sinai, present yourself to me there on top of the mountain. No one is to come with you or be seen anywhere in the mountain, not even the flocks, the herd may graze, etc. Moses chiseled out two stone tablets, and Sinai went up, etc., etc. Then the Lord came down, proclaimed, and stood there and proclaimed his name, the Lord. And he passed in front of Moses, proclaiming the Lord, gracious, compassionate, passionate, etc., etc. Moving right along. Moses bowed to the ground. Let's see here. I'm making a covenant with you before all your people. I will do wonders. And then here we get into these commandments. The people you live among will see how awesome is the work that I, the Lord, will do for you. Obey what I've commanded you today. I will drive out before you the Amorites, Hittites, be careful not to make a treaty with those. Break down their altars, smash their sacred stones, cut down their Asherah poles. Do not worship any other god, for the Lord, whose name is Jealous, is a jealous God. Now, clearly that corresponds to the first commandment. Okay? Be careful not to make a treaty with those who live in the land. For when they prostitute themselves to their gods and sacrifice them, they will invite you to eat with them, etc., etc. So that's very similar to the first commandment, right? Do not make cast idols. Well, there's a second commandment for you. Celebrate the Feast of Unleavened Bread. 7 days eat bread made without yeast as I commanded you. Now that's not anywhere in the Ten Commandments. Okay? The first offspring of every womb belongs to me, including all the firstborn males of your livestock, whether from the flock or herd. Redeem the firstborn donkey with a lamb, etc. That's not in the Ten Commandments. No one is to appear before me empty-handed. 6 days you shall labor. On the seventh day you shall do your rest. There's the Sabbath day, right? Celebrate the Feast of Weeks with the first fruits of the wheat harvest. So there we have a celebration of a feast, which, again, is not mentioned in the Ten Commandments. Okay, 3 times a year your men are to appear before me, before the Lord God. Do not offer blood of a sacrifice to me with anything containing yeast. Okay? Do not let the sacrifice from the Passover feast remain until morning. Bring the best fruits of the land of your soil to the house of the Lord your God. Do not cook a young goat in its mother's milk. Then the Lord said to Moses, write down these commands, for in accordance with these words, I have made a covenant with you and in Israel. Moses was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights without eating bread or drinking water, and he wrote on the tablets the word of the covenant, the Ten Commandments. Okay? So, this is the argument. Scholars say that the original Ten Commandments included this list of feasts and these things regarding the sacrifices and so on. And so there were actually 2 different versions of the Ten Commandments. There was the Exodus 20 version, and then there's Exodus 34 version, which included all these things regarding these various kinds of feasts and sacrifices and so on, because it says he wrote down the words of the covenant, the Ten Commandments. But
yeah.
I don't think that there's any reason to assume that the Ten Commandments refers to all those things that he just said up there, you know? And I've counted them several times, all the different commandments in that list, and there's no way I can get 10 out of it. I think that he's saying, yeah, he wrote down the Ten Commandments, but there's also all these other laws that he's mentioning as well. He's not designating that those laws in Exodus 34 are the Ten Commandments. So I do not think that constitutes a different version of the Ten Commandments, personally. Okay? How about Deuteronomy 5, because that's the other one. So, yeah. Exodus 34 is a compendium of laws. Deuteronomy 5, of course, this is a better case, because in Deuteronomy 5, we have a version that is very, very similar to the ones in Exodus 20, and Moses says at the beginning, you know, these are the commandments which God gave us. But there are some differences. For instance, let's look at a couple of things here. So Exodus 20, here's a big one. Here's the first one. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. The seventh day is the Sabbath day. You shall not do any work. You, your sons, livestock, for in 6 days the Lord God made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that's in them, but rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and consecrated it. Why are we to keep the Sabbath day? According to Exodus 20, because on the seventh day of creation God rested. Okay. How about Deuteronomy 5? Observe the Sabbath day and keep it holy as the Lord your God commanded you. 6 days you shall do your work, etc., etc. Why? Remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out from there with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord commanded you to keep the Sabbath day. Okay? So we have a different rationale in Deuteronomy 5 than we have in Exodus 20. Exodus 20 roots the Sabbath day in creation. Deuteronomy 5 in the act of deliverance which occurred in the Exodus. Okay? And then we have the coveting thing here, just a small difference here. You shall not covet your neighbor's house, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, male or female slave, ox, donkey, anything that belongs to your neighbor. Deuteronomy 5, neither shall you covet your neighbor's wife, neither shall you desire your neighbor's house or field or male servant or female servant or ox or donkey or anything that belongs to the neighbor. Interesting little difference here. My sense is that Deuteronomy is a later and more reflected version of the Ten Commandments. Why are the Israelites to observe the law? Well, we might say that the ontological reason. The reason in being is because God established it at creation, whereas sort of the moral reason is that you yourselves know what it's like to be worked real hard and to struggle, and so because you've had to go through that, you should be caring and considerate of other people who have to struggle. So take a day off, give yourselves a break, give your slaves a break, give your servants a break, give your animals a break, because it's the right thing to do and you should know it because you've been there. And this is very, very kind of typical of Deuteronomy and Deuteronomy's way of arguing, you know, to hearken back to the Exodus. So they're saying the same thing, basically. They're just giving it a different basis. Deuteronomy with the coveting, this is going to be significant for reasons that we'll get into later. They move wife to the front and separate it from the others to a certain extent in Deuteronomy. They also add fields. And my thinking is the reason why they add fields is just to bring the number of things that are coveted here to 7. Yeah. Because, you know, they like completion, right? So you mention a list of 7 things and then you say, nor anything that belongs to your neighbor. You know, 7 is the number of completion. So you're saying, okay, here's 7 things and, you know, you're not supposed to covet any of these. And that basically this means by listing 7 things, you're saying don't covet anything of your neighbor's. Why do we move the wife to the front? I say who knows, but part of the reason is that Deuteronomy might be trying to reflect a tradition that does not identify the wife with household property. Now, it is easy to read Exodus 20 and the coveting command as saying, all the possessions of your neighbor, including his wife. That's one way you could read it. I don't think you have to read it that way, and I'll get to that, of course, when we talk about that commandment. But it is possible that Deuteronomy wants to make it clear that a wife is not to be considered among a man's possessions, and so that might be why they've moved it to the front. That's just a guess on my part. But I do think that Exodus 20 does represent the original form of the Ten Commandments, and I think that any other reconstructions is just speculation and doesn't have a whole lot of basis for it. Another question about the Ten Commandments. Is it 10 or is it 11? Well, everybody agrees it's 10 Commandments because the Bible says it's 10 Commandments, but there is a difference in how you count them. For instance, I am the Lord your God who spoke all these, who brought you out of Egypt, out of land of slavery. You shall have no other gods before me. Let's just bring these up here real quick. Don't make for yourselves an idol. For those people who can only remember 4 of them, here they are. Don't misuse the name of your Lord your God. I don't like this command, this translation. It really, you know, don't take the Lord your God in the name of your Lord and God in vain, the way the old King James Version did it, really is the best translation. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Honor your father and mother. Don't murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. Don't give false testimony. Don't covet your neighbor's house. Again, I would translate this a little different. Rather than house, I would translate that as household. Do not covet your neighbor's household. We're not talking, I don't think, about a physical structure. And I'll get to that also when we talk about this later. Structure of the Ten Commandments. This is something that has a little bit of question, a little bit of debate behind it. I don't think that the order is random. There is a well-designed structure here. First of all, we have Commandments 1 through 3, which are all about our obligations to God. This is another reason, by the way, why I think Exodus 20 is the more authentic version, is because it has this very clear structure, very clear pattern, which is not reflected in some of the other versions as well. Commandments 1 through 3, human obligations to God. Then we come to an obligation not only to God, but to creation in the Sabbath day, you know? Why do we keep the Sabbath? Well, it's not because we are honoring God. It's also because we are preserving our society. We are being good to our fellow human beings. We're being good to nature, our fields, and so on. And, you know, there's a lot of talk in the Bible about giving your lands a Sabbath day, giving years, as the case may be. But the idea is that that land needs a rest, too. And, of course, your animals. So not only is this about an obligation to God, but an obligation to all of creation. And then we go into the next one, and we have honor your father and mother. And this is the beginning of our obligations to other human beings. Okay? And it is interesting that it starts with honor your father and mother, which would seem to be a rather minor thing to us, rather than starting with the biggie, which would be don't kill. But there is a reason for that, which we will get to when we talk about that commandment. And then 6 through 9, our obligations to other people and kind of descending order of severity. And I've had some arguments with theologians who argue, no, you have to count them all the same. Every sin is the same. No, that's not true. You know, you ask somebody, would you rather have somebody steal your purse or murder you? To say that those are equivalent is ridiculous. You know, no, there's clearly a reduction in order of severity here. From murder to adultery, which was considered very, very bad, to stealing from somebody, to telling false things about them or telling things about them that you shouldn't be saying. And then on down to the last one, which is about our inner life. So we're moving from obligations to God through our obligations to other people to really an obligation to our thought life and to honoring and to ordering our thought life. So let's kind of bring this home here. Let's talk a little bit about how we're going to interpret the Ten Commandments real quick. So first of all, we do need to read them in their historical cultural context. And this is very important to understand why adultery was so bad to people in the ancient world. It was very different understanding than what we understand adultery to be today. There's a whole bunch of cultural baggage behind the idea of not bearing false witness, you know? So look at these things in their context. The commandments are designed for ancient Israel, not for modern America. Putting them up in our courtrooms might not be the best and wisest case because we are not ancient Israel. You know, we do not have a theocracy. We are not under the rule of God as a nation. I know some people would argue, well, we should be. Personally, I don't buy that. I believe that we have, our citizenship is in the kingdom of God, and that is whom God rules over, not any political entities in this day and age. But anyway, the values expressed here work in the context of a theocracy, a people ruled by God. The commandments are a harbinger of Israel's failures. You know, David Noel Friedman, a number of years back, wrote a book that I don't think really convinced anybody, but was very intriguing because he argued that the entire history of Israel basically is based upon failures of the Ten Commandments, and that in each of these cases we go through each book of the Old Testament, we see a different commandment emphasized. And sometimes his arguments are pretty creative, but the point being, I guess, that the fact that you could make that argument with a straight face shows that really it's the Ten Commandments are a litany which foretells the failures of Israel, particularly that with that first commandment, which is the big one about worshiping other gods. Read them also in literary and theological context, okay? We realize that the Ten Commandments are part of the Hebrew Bible canon. That is the way they were understood. They were understood to have their fulfillment and to all be fleshed out in other books of the Old Testament. And now, of course, for us as Christians, we read them also in the light of what is taught by Jesus. And there's this little thing called the Sermon on the Mount, where Jesus goes through several of these commandments and talks about them in great detail. And those principles that Jesus lays out there are really the major foundation for the way that we are to understand how the Ten Commandments apply to us in our day and our lives. Now, one more question that I'm going to get into here, and I'm not going to be able to give it the attention that it should have, but I do need to touch upon it at least. Are Christians obligated to keep the Ten Commandments?
Yeah.
You go online on the internet, you will find a ton of websites where people are arguing that the Ten Commandments have been totally abrogated, that they have no bearing on the Christian life today. Which, you know, and it seems like what they really fixate on is the Sabbath commandment. You know, I think that what you have here is some people who used to be Sabbatarians and then left the movement and now have a chip on their shoulder. And so they say, well, we just don't keep any of the law, right? So if we don't keep any of the law, obviously we don't have to keep the Sabbath day. But are we under an obligation? I do think that, let's go for the first one here. Almost no Christians argue today that people can do anything they want, obviously, but many argue that we have no obligation to keep Old Testament laws, which is, to some extent, you know, supported by a number of passages in the Bible. You know, Paul wrote, "By works of the law shall no flesh be justified." So we cannot justify ourselves by how many of the laws we keep. We are not saved by keeping the laws. But I would argue, neither was Israel, we'll talk about that in a minute, we are not spiritually bound to keep the law, but neither was ancient Israel, but, you know, the laws did order their society to some extent. I do not believe that the Old Testament is obsolete, and I have that on good authority from this guy called Jesus. You know, do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish them, but to fulfill them. And there are those who argue that, well, the law was fulfilled when Jesus died on the cross. I don't think so. I think that what Jesus is talking about there is when his kingdom comes in its fullness. That's usually the way Jesus talks about the fulfillment of his mission. His mission was not fulfilled when he rose from the dead. His mission will be fulfilled when he returns in his final glory and his kingdom comes in its fullness. And that is when the law will not be necessary anymore, because it will be written upon our hearts. And none of us will have to be giving lectures about the meaning of the Ten Commandments, because as the book of Jeremiah tells us, nobody will have to say to his neighbor, know the Lord, because they will all know the Lord. That's not happened now. It will not happen until the kingdom of God comes in its fullness. So, Jesus' approach to the law is to observe the intention of the laws. And this we see very clearly in his Sermon on the Mount. And that, as I go through the Ten Commandments, that is what we're going to emphasize over and over again, is the fact that we are to keep the intention of the laws rather than the letter of the laws. And Paul says, the letter kills, but the Spirit makes alive. And we could say that's speaking of the Holy Spirit, but that Holy Spirit is the Spirit of the laws. And so by keeping the Spirit of the laws, we can fulfill, we can be walking in ways that are pleasing to God. Now, I think I am going to bring this to an end here. I actually have several more slides that I could bring up about the new perspective on Paul and so on, but I think I'm going to pass on that, because I think this is a good place to draw this to a close.
This is Dr. Anthony J. Tomasino and his teaching on the Ten Commandments. This is session number 1, the Ten Commandments and the Law.